From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. President Trump has taken a different approach than his predecessors to cyber warfare. During a recent trip to Raleigh, a national reporter offered an update on Trump's policy and its potential impact. This is the first time in 9 years that State Senate leader Phil Berger has no Republican supermajority. What will that mean for state policy? Berger has some ideas. Lawmakers recently debated the impact of a new state law involving campaign finance investigations. You'll hear their comments. And we'll delve into a scandal involving Buncombe County and a local sales tax. It was approved for renovations and repairs to the local community college, but ended up getting used for something else. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
For about 10,000 North Carolina school kids, our state's private school choice programs are making a huge difference in their lives this school year. Opportunity scholarships, disability grants, and education savings accounts are just three components of North Carolina's growing list of options for parents and kids. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation, is very aware of all of these programs. He's here to talk a little bit about these three in particular. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Opportunity scholarships. Tell us who's eligible and where you can actually use this scholarship and how much.
The Opportunity Scholarship is for low-income children, and the amount of the scholarship is up to $4,200 toward the private school tuition. One of the things about the Opportunity Scholarship, as well as the disability grant that we'll talk about later, is that you have to spend 1 year in public school before you are eligible to receive the grant. So that means that current private school students can't receive a disability grant or an opportunity scholarship. The idea there is that to eliminate some of the deadweight loss, in other words, to provide actual savings to the state by having students move from the public school to the private school. So that's the idea there. So it's for primarily low-income kids. There are also other eligible populations, but that's the primary focus of the Opportunity Scholarship.
How long has this been in place?
This has been in place for about 4 years now, and we continue to see growth, significant interest and significant growth in the number of students who are receiving an Opportunity Scholarship, and we surpassed the 8,000 mark this year, and I think we'll probably in the next 2 years surpass the 10,000 mark. So we've been seeing steady growth. We've been seeing a lot of students, even eligible students, applying for the grant. And in the end, there are some who decide to take it and some who don't. But the parents that we've heard from really appreciate having the option of taking the grant or not taking the grant. And they appreciate having the opportunity to be able to receive an opportunity scholarship.
That's really interesting that you said that some will apply for it and then decide it's not the right thing for them. And that really is kind of the essence of what the school choice movement is all about, to let a parent have options and then for him or her to decide this works best for my kid or it doesn't work best. Do we have any sense of what the parents who are opting in for an opportunity scholarship, what their situations are? Do we know anything or see any trends about who it is that's really taking advantage of these?
Well, about half of those who receive it are white, low-income families. The other half are from ethnic and racial minority groups. So it's pretty evenly split between the two. And we see that parents, based on surveys from NC State University, are really looking for a few things when they take an opportunity scholarship. They want a safe environment for their child. They want academic rigor. There are other factors that are involved, such as proximity. So there are a number of factors that parents are looking for when they pursue an opportunity scholarship for their child. One thing that's very low on the list, and I think it's worth mentioning, is that athletics. We always hear that people want to move to private school for athletics purposes. No, this is not a reason why parents are choosing to receive an opportunity scholarship for their child. It's mainly for academic and for safety reasons and many other reasons that are sometimes hard to quantify.
Is there a limited number of private school options then that a parent could choose if they opt into the scholarship program?
Well, the schools have to participate in the program, and there are some that choose not to participate in the program for whatever reason. We've heard from some schools, for example, that are concerned that if they receive opportunity scholarship students, that will invite the state to add regulations to their school, and so they choose not to participate. There are hundreds of private schools that do participate in the program, that do accept these students. So generally, there's a lot of options for students. Now, of course, there's going to be fewer options in rural communities that just naturally have fewer private schools. But still, I think very, very good opportunities for most of the students in the state.
And for this school year, again, we're talking about around 8,500 recipients of this scholarship. Let's move on to the disability grant, a much more specialized population of kids that this grant is catering to. Right now, it looks like about 1,200 are participating in this grant program. Tell us more about it.
Well, these are children that have an individualized education plan, or an IEP. And this is a plan for the school to provide accommodations for whatever disability that the student has. It's a very formalized contract. It's a legally binding contract. And so only students that have this IEP are eligible for the disability grant. And because of the increased costs of educating disabled students, this is an $8,000 grant, which is, of course, much larger than the opportunity scholarship, given the additional costs that are involved. And that's why we see fewer students taking the disability grant, because not everyone has this IEP. And so naturally, there are going to be fewer of those students participating that are eligible, and then fewer still that are participating.
Are the parents who are receiving the disability grant, are they using this in conjunction with the education savings account that North Carolina now has?
Most are. Now, the education savings account gives parents the ultimate flexibility in how the money is spent, because unlike the disability grant and the opportunity scholarship, they don't have to just use it on private school tuition. They could use it on therapy. They can use it on instructional aids and any number of qualified expenses. And a lot of these students have very severe disabilities that not only require them to be in a school, but require them to receive after-school therapy, whether it be speech therapy or physical therapy. And that's an additional cost. So you see students or families that have children with severe disabilities taking advantage of both programs, the $8,000 disability grant and the $9,000 education savings account, using them in conjunction to provide, to customize their education for their special needs child.
Now, Terry, we know that these three programs, the opportunity scholarship, the disability grant, the education savings account, it's about 10,000 kids who are taking advantage of these three programs. So on the one hand, that's a pretty large number of people. On the other hand, a very low percentage of the number of kids who are actually in the school age arena. So where does that put North Carolina in terms of choice? Are we offering enough options to parents, or are they demanding more?
They're definitely demanding more. The one complaint we've heard about the Opportunity Scholarship, for example, is that because it's only $4,200, and private school tuition is usually much more than that, the parents are unable to pay for the gap in between what they get for the Opportunity Scholarship and what the school charges for tuition. Now, many private schools provide scholarships, or they remit the tuition for Opportunity Scholarship children, but there still is a need to increase that amount. I think that's the one overwhelming message that we get from parents, is that $4,200 just isn't enough for this program.
Now, when you couple these programs with the other choice options, charters, homeschools, private schools, virtual schools, now the number starts to get a lot bigger, maybe about 20% of North Carolina kids?
Yeah, we are approaching 20% of students in non-district schools, which is pretty remarkable and is among the leaders in the nation. Our mix is a little bit different than most states, but I think that this is going to continue to increase because the enrollment growth is really in these choice programs rather than in the district enrollment.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He continues to follow the school choice movement. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Mention the words battle or warfare, and you're likely to conjure images of troops fighting it out on a physical battlefield. Our next guest says the most important battlefield for the United States today is actually cyberspace. Shane Harris is a staff writer for the Washington Post. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation, the theme, The Rise of Cyber Warfare and the State of National Security Under Trump. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So basically, you gave a history lesson to folks for the John Locke Foundation of how cyber warfare has come to be seen going back to the George W. Bush administration. And one of your key points was that things under Donald Trump are different than they were under both George W. Bush and President Obama. How so?
Well, the main difference is that with Presidents Bush and Obama, you had this top-level recognition of cyberspace as a place where governments were conducting espionage against us, stealing information, stealing secrets, stealing proprietary commercial information, and also a place that we needed to be prepared to do battle with other countries, steal their information, attack their networks, this kind of thing. This president really hasn't seemed to reckon with the strategic vulnerability that exists there. And this is most prominently expressed in his continued resistance to acknowledge that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. Obviously, he has a lot of sensitivity around the question of them intervening to somehow try to assist his efforts in the election. But he has also really not grappled, I think, with the way that that attack exposed so many vulnerabilities in the way that our electoral system could be probed, voting rolls could be infiltrated, and also how emails and other proprietary information could be stolen and weaponized against a political candidate, and how social media could be polluted with fake messages to try and influence people's decisions. These are all tactics that intelligence officials for many years have understood governments use and have used in other places. And President Trump really hasn't seemed to recognize that. And I think that that keeps him from forming a strategic approach to how to think about defending cyberspace the way that his predecessors did.
Is this just President Trump, or does this extend to the people around him as well? Because he's not focusing on it, or because he is not acknowledging it, others are also setting it aside?
I think that there's certainly activity that is going on, and people in government are focusing on this. But when you don't have that top-level sort of North Star kind of guidance coming from the president, it doesn't give it urgency. And so the problem doesn't have the same level of urgency that I think that it did under President Obama, under President Bush.
What are the consequences if we don't do anything about it? If basically we say, this is not a priority, We're not going to focus on it.
Well, the consequences are that things keep getting worse. So China continues stealing intellectual property from American companies. Russia continues trying to meddle in our election. Iran continues trying to penetrate systems that control the power grid and other critical infrastructures. And again, it's not to say that there aren't places in the government that are aware of that and are trying to work to defend against it. But I think that what history has shown is that you have to have a strategic vision for this area because it's so new and because there needs to be real guidance and kind of doctrine from the top. I mean, think about it this way too. There's no incentive right now for the Homeland Security Department to mount a big aggressive effort to try and counter Russian propaganda ahead of the 2018 midterms. We have seen some statements coming out that are fairly high level, but there's not really a big incentive to try to re-attack the problem that happened in 2016 because that's so politically sensitive for the president. So in the absence of real guidance, we are maybe letting our guard down, I think.
Shane Harris is staff writer for The Washington Post. He's been focusing on these issues for a number of years. And Shane, some people who are supporters of the president are saying, look, this is all fake news. Mm-hmm. This is not an issue. This is all Democrats trying to get some political spin that will be to the detriment of Donald Trump. Why can we not approach the situation that way?
Well, I think first of all, it's not fake news, and every single intelligence official in the U.S. government who serves at the pleasure of Donald Trump is on record saying that the Russians did this in 2016, exactly as the previous administration said. Many of those officials who came to that assessment, some of them even carried over from the Obama administration. So this isn't a partisan position to say that Russia did this. What I would hope is that the political conversation could change to acknowledge that this was something that was done to the United States as opposed to Hillary Clinton or to Donald Trump or on behalf of. Those things did happen. But if we're going to get to a point where we can resolve this and talk about the real genuine nonpartisan national security threat this poses, I think to some degree it's going to require the president just acknowledging what everyone else, Republican and Democrat, says. Also, no one is out there saying, with very, very few exceptions, that but for the Russian intervention, Hillary Clinton would have won. No one's trying to make that case. So this isn't an effort to try to delegitimize the election of the president. I think it's more properly seen as an effort to get the government to wake up to a real national security threat that we clearly weren't prepared for.
We've been talking about Russia, but Russia isn't the only actor we need to worry about, is it?
Right. Right. So China poses a major economic threat. For years, they've been stealing intellectual property and trade secrets from American companies and then giving those to Chinese businesses to accelerate their own economy. We did sign a deal with China in 2015 whereby they're supposed to stop that activity. There are mixed reviews on whether they have, but they still pose a tremendous espionage threat as well, trying to steal government secrets. Russia, we've talked about. Iran has been incredibly active in this space over the past six or so years. In fact, it wasn't that long ago where the supreme leader in Iran was talking notionally about the idea of developing what he called a cyber army. And today, Iran has one. It primarily uses it to attack Saudi Arabia and other interests in the region, but it has reached out and tried to attack critical infrastructure in the U.S. And then, of course, North Korea actually did launch an attack on an American company, wiping out tons of computers and data at Sony Pictures a few years ago. And while we're now in a conversation with North Korea about trying to denuclearize its weapons program, it is still building a cyber program that you could imagine kind of coming in and, if not exactly taking the place of a nuclear program, becoming another way that North Korea could menace the United States and its adversaries in the region.
One of the things that you mentioned in your speech to the John Locke Foundation is that this is somehow a fifth domain of warfare going along with the air, land, sea, and space, and the only one in which we don't already have some dominance.
Yeah.
Why is it important for us to sort of make that a key factor moving forward?
I think because Americans have become complacent to some degree with the strength of our military and the recognition that very few countries can really credibly challenge us. Some can't challenge us at all. And if we begin to think that we exercise that same level of dominance in cyberspace, we really underestimate the sophistication and the threat that our adversaries pose. The barrier to entry to being able to have a credible attack capability in cyberspace is incredibly low compared to the ability to field a standing army or build aircraft carriers and ships that can go around the world or planes that can fly by stealth. We can do all those things. Most countries can't. It doesn't take that much to get a sophisticated group of people together and form a cyber force that can steal your secrets, that can penetrate computers, that can control critical infrastructure. It's not trivial. But the barrier to entry is not even comparable to what it is in the traditional military domain. So if we don't reckon with that and recognize that we are not always going to be the strongest and the best in this area, then we are setting ourselves up to be taken by surprise.
Someone who is monitoring this very closely in his job as a staff writer for the Washington Post is Shane Harris. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Republican Phil Berger is starting his ninth year as leader of the North Carolina State Senate. But this year is different. For the first time since he assumed the leadership role in 2011, he won't have a veto-proof Republican supermajority working with him. Just after his election to a fifth consecutive term as Senate leader, Berger discussed the new environment.
Change has now come to the political landscape. The voters returned Republican majorities to the legislature, but not a supermajority, which means that a Republican majority cannot, on its own, override a governor's veto. Legislative Democrats and the executive branch will have the opportunity for more influence over the policymaking process. Some might look at that and say that I must be disappointed. The reality is that I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that now we can put political battles behind us and find common ground in advancing our shared interest in helping North Carolina continue to grow and prosper. Until now, conversations, opinion pieces, and strategic thinking about the Republican supermajority and what that meant for the power dynamic in the state was focused on just that, a supermajority, and how a supermajority results in appeals to that majority's base or core voters. But not much attention was paid to an equal and opposite position, the superminority, if you will. For years, minority legislators had the freedom, even the luxury, some might say, of appealing to their base, their national political voters, and their ideological agenda setters, without responsibility for actual governance. They could toe the party line, duck substantive give and take, attack, and litigate at every turn. And regrettably, some of the language used to describe the motives behind honest policy differences has incited misplaced anger. That just drives us further apart and makes cooperation more difficult. But this session, hopefully, will be different. Republicans will have to work across the aisle, but so will Democrats. If we are to have a successful session, we all will have to accept outcomes that do not cater to the extremes. I know we're capable of this, and so do you. We all know that the vast majority of bills that come out of this chamber are unanimous. But we're going to have to find ways for collaboration on more subjects. Our response to Hurricane Florence recovery shows what's possible.
That's Republican State Senator Phil Berger. He's leading the North Carolina Senate for a ninth consecutive year. Berger is discussing opportunities for bipartisanship over the next 2 years. This is the first time in Berger's tenure as Senate leader that he won't have a veto-proof Republican supermajority. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers recently voted to override a veto from Governor Roy Cooper. First, they wanted to correct the record. Cooper said the bill would add a new level of secrecy to campaign finance investigations. Democratic Representative Robert Reeves echoed Cooper's concerns.
The biggest concern that I heard that the governor had, and I would also have, would be the change in the rules on campaign finance. These investigations affect both sides of the aisle. This isn't a partisan issue that I can see. I don't understand how it could become a partisan issue because it's happened to everybody at some point in time. But I do think it's important that we have open, transparent investigations and open, transparent discussions when there are issues.
Even some Republicans, like Representative Larry Pittman, objected to portions of the bill.
One of my problems is in Section 4, the part about putting some limitations on investigations of like 4 years. I won't mention names, but I know of a certain member who, not in this chamber but in the other, took years and years and years before something was finally done about his situation. And I just don't think we ought to be limiting it like that. I think that section of this bill limits transparency. when the people have a right to expect transparency and integrity of their elected officials. I think wanting to limit that, I personally don't see the need for that, because if you hadn't done anything wrong, I know I haven't, so I'm not too worried about it. They can audit me if they want to. They can bring charges against me. I know I haven't done anything. So if you haven't done anything, why worry about that?
But supporters of the bill responded. One, Democrat Dwayne Hall, chastised colleagues for tying the bill to the ongoing controversy surrounding North Carolina's 9th congressional district.
This has become an insane political football, in my opinion. Bladen County is a horrible violation, but had nothing to do with this. The scandal that happened there didn't happen or continue to happen because they failed to report the investigation or expose it. There was no investigation. There should have been there. It's a completely separate issue. We're making a political football out of something that's not what happened.
Republican Sarah Stevens placed some of the blame on media coverage.
The press has got it all wrong. They said this is about trying to keep secret certain things. Well, it's not. When a complaint is filed with the Board of Elections about campaign finance or anything, should it be made immediately public? What we've said is it needs to go on to the Board of Ethics before it becomes public. People ought to have had the opportunity to offer their side before it simply is made public on someone's allegation. It could be that you failed to document properly your mileage. It could be that you accidentally got a campaign contribution that you perhaps didn't need. But you haven't had the opportunity to respond, particularly right here before an election. You may not have had an opportunity to respond. But you're tarred with that allegation, regardless of whether you've had the opportunity to respond to it. So this is giving a little time to get everything a fair treatment. This is not about covering up something. This is about making sure you got a fair opportunity to hear both sides.
Stevens and her House colleagues voted to override the veto. So did the Senate, where Republican Dan Bishop explained why lawmakers made changes to rules involving campaign finance investigations.
The bill put everything back in the governor's partisan control. But to round off the rough edge of a political operation ever so slightly, the bill included very limited, very reasonable, very common procedural protections. And one was that campaign finance investigations by the board must be confidential. Now, there was good reason for that. What happened 9 weeks ago? Then Chairman Penry of the Board of Elections insisted on forcing a hearing on an 18-month-old campaign finance complaint over mileage reimbursements against a Republican senator on the first day of early voting. The senator's opponent, of course, pointed to the hearing and said, well, that senator might be going to jail soon. Absurd though that was. Even worse, that senator's campaign treasurer, his mother, was in a hospital bed receiving treatment for cancer, but that did not deter then-Chairman Penry. Only when a whistleblower told reporters that the board's investigation wasn't even complete did Mr. Penry finally back off. Now, of course, since then, Chairman Penry had to resign the board in disgrace because of overtly partisan activities of his on the side. And that's what we had in mind when we included the provision that campaign finance investigation should be confidential until complete, something that's familiar to prosecutors and investigators everywhere, because destroying reputations through drawn-out series of press releases or media leaks is wrong for any agency charged with the serious task of investigating criminal law violations, and especially for a bare-knuckle political operation that the governor has won by lawsuit. It will require fairness for Democratic candidates when a Republican is the governor. And honestly, to hear a Democrat on this floor say words to the effect, if you weren't guilty, why would you be accused? I mean, I would expect the solicitousness for protections of the accused to come particularly from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. Instead, what we hear is something along the lines of, why would that person have been arrested if they weren't guilty? Or the ominous words that came out of the Soviet Union, show me the man, I'll show you the crime.
Republican Senator Paul Newton told a story to help explain his support for the campaign finance investigation changes.
I get a text from a friend. I would call him a good friend. I know he's a Democrat. He used to be a nonpartisan elected official. And he says, Paul, I think, you know, I'd like you to not vote for the veto override because of the secrecy involved in this bill. So his concern about secrecy has got to be coming from the governor. He's a good Democrat. He's listening to the governor. And so I did a little research, pulled up the NNO article to understand what our governor is saying about this bill. He said it mandates secrecy and makes it harder to prosecute those who break the law. He goes on to say, tell legislators that you don't want to protect politicians who commit fraud. Don't let the last act make it easier on criminals. So I texted my good friend, and here's what I told him. The confidentiality provision in the override only protects people against false allegations. As you know, a mere allegation can ruin one's career and good name. If there is merit to the allegation, it will become known to all. Colleagues, I just encourage you as we move forward in the spirit of bipartisanship in 2019 that we remember that facts matter, and facts should matter as we make arguments about legislation. And it is factual. I believe my response to my friend is factual. So we are not condoning secrecy. We're not condoning criminality. This is common sense, and it protects one's career from false allegations being made against you.
You've been listening to Legislative Debate. It focused on a measure to change rules linked to state campaign finance investigations. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. When Buncombe County voters narrowly approved a 2011 sales tax hike, it was promised the funds would pay for a $130 million repair and renovation plan for Asheville-Buncombe Technical Community College. But that has not happened as promised. Joe Coletti is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Now, Joe has been looking into this years-long diversion of revenue into Buncombe County's general operating fund. He's also been writing about what some local officials want to do about it all now. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Tell us how this information even came to light, because it's a pretty incredible story about how all of this was discovered.
Yeah, Buncombe County's been an interesting place for a while now. Their former county manager, Wanda Green, a couple of her assistant managers, and her son, who is also a Buncombe County employee, have all been indicted or in some process of being investigated. And that's been going on for a year and a half. She resigned last year. In amidst all of this, for kickbacks and embezzlement and a number of other things, she has since paid back, agreed to pay back $750,000 to the county. The assistant managers have each agreed about $189,000 each. Her son is still working that out. But while she was gone, they appointed an interim county manager, George Wood, and as a good county manager, he started looking into the funds. For those who are familiar with Wake County and the Register of Deeds fiasco here, right? It's you bring in somebody new, they start taking a look, and then they start raising flags. And that's what he did. And he said, y'all have been diverting funds, and you've been doing this in a way that is not sustainable. You've been not only taking money from this that was promised to the community college, with which the county commissioners knew they were doing and approved in votes, but you've been using this money to paper over recurring deficits that you've been running. And that is where he started, where he really raised the question and said, this is not a sustainable practice. And, but once he brought that to their attention and did that in open forum, that led the Asheville Citizens Times to do some serious digging, and they came up with a lot more on it.
We're going to talk in a moment about what some of the local officials there now are proposing to be done about this, since this new county manager says, hey, this can't continue to go on. Right. The money just won't last. Take us back, though, first to 2011 about how this all started. There right. was something on the ballot in Buncombe County the voters decided.
Yeah. So in 2011, Buncombe County asked voters for a quarter cent sales tax increase. And a number of counties across the state have asked for similar things. Buncombe County found that the best way to do that is to have it as a standalone measure on the November ballot that year. So there were no local elections to or no state elections, nothing else on that ballot, just this one question. And so they had a really low turnout, and it won by about 500 votes. But the campaign was based on the folks who were in support of the sales tax increase guaranteed that the money would all go to ABTEC, the Asheville Buncombe Technical Community College, and to help pay for a lot of capital needs that they had. And a portion of the money, most of the money, all of the money the first year did, and most of the money over the next few years did. But in the last 3 years, more and more money has been going to the general operating fund instead of to the community colleges. And so, and the community college still has a large, unfunded, backlog of repairs, renovations, and so they've been able to build some of the buildings, but not all of the money has gone to them. So $15 million has been diverted. And in 2011, Michael Cenera, who retired from the John Locke Foundation, warned and others warned that
this kind of thing could happen.
This is a tax. There's no guarantee that the money is going to go where it's promised to go, and future county commissioners can change their minds, and that's what they've done.
Joe, at some point along the way, do we know if officials at the community college there started kind of raising their hands and saying, hey, but we thought back in 2011 this money was going to be coming to us, or did this just go really kind of unreported and unremarkable?
They started to question it before the county before the county manager found everything this past June, it was, you know, they were still getting $6 million for the first couple years when the county commission bumped up the amount that was going into the general fund instead of to the community college. They also bumped up the amount that was going to the community college, so they went from about $500,000 to the general fund to about $2 million. And through that whole period, the college was still getting $6 million a year. Then they bumped up the county portion to $5.8 million. And that same year, they bumped up the college portion to $7.8 million.
So there was enough money that was flowing into the college that were seeing a little bit of activity and improvements. And so it really didn't get a whole lot of questions.
And they were still able to go ahead with their with some of their buildings that they had planned that they said that the money was going to go to. So they opened a health services building. They opened, they then in 2017, tore down an existing facility that they were hoping to replace with a new classroom facility. That still hasn't been approved by the county commission, and it's not clear that they have the money to actually go ahead with the construction either.
Now we have this new county manager who has replaced Wanda Green and that whole regime. And this new county manager is now saying, look, we can't continue to do this. The money isn't going to last. So what's been the reaction from officials who can make votes on what to do and from the public on this?
Yeah, well, the public obviously is in an uproar because that's not what we wanted. That's not what we voted for. One of the county commissioners, Fryer, has said that we should just take this back to the people. We should be honest about what we're doing, and ask for a new vote on this sales tax. So one of the other things is that the sales tax was supposed to cover, you know, a set amount of construction needs, but it's in perpetuity. They said that would go away, but they have to. Then the county commission has to vote for it to go away. So their suggestion is now that they should have a new vote to see what the people want to do with the
to
money.
See whether they want to continue with this increase in the sales tax rate or whether they want to do away with it and say enough already.
Yeah. So yeah, the county commission can vote on their own to end the sales tax. They just need approval to create a new tax. So the idea is let's have a new vote.
That doesn't happen very often, right?
No, nobody is just going to give away money, right?
Stream, who wants to end that? Yeah, local officials are want to do that.
Right. And so there's that option. And the state representative from Asheville, Brian Taylor, has said that there should be some new safeguards put in place within the county to make sure that the money's going to the colleges, and they should institute a payment plan because there's no way that the county commission can give back all the money that they've taken from that was supposed to go to the college.
Amazing. Joe, what really strikes me out of this is something you said a few moments ago, that when these things are passed, And it's, quote, guaranteed that we're going to spend this new revenue on X, Y, and Z. Really, there's no such guarantee.
There's never a guarantee. The only way that you can be assured that the money is going to go to something is with a bond, right? And that's not what this is. A tax is just general fund revenue, regardless of how things get apportioned.
We've been talking with Joe Coletti. He is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. You can read his writings about this issue in Buncombe County at johnlocke.org. Joe, thanks so much for sharing it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.